And welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman. For the next few months, people who visit the Frost Museum at FIU will have a chance to see a whole different South Beach. Gary Monroe was in his early 20s when he decided he was going to go out and shoot photos of his neighborhood just about every day. The project went on for almost 10 years, from 1977 to 1986, and some of those photos just went up, again, at the Frost Museum at Florida International University in Miami. He'll be there tomorrow for a conversation about the project that's open to the public. And this conversation right now with Gary Monroe is open to the public as well. Thanks very much for coming into the studio, Gary.
Thanks for the invitation.
So I said that you shot photos of the neighborhood, but really you were taking photos of people who lived in South Beach, the people who lived in South Beach in the 70s and 80s.
Precisely.
Who were they?
They were the last leg of an Eastern European Jewry that made South Beach the last resort. And growing up in South Beach, we didn't quite know what we had there. And back then, South Beach was sort of an embarrassment to Miami. There were no young people there, no clubs. It was just the opposite. But I had a sense when I went away to college that it represented a very precious legacy, whose roots, of course, went back to the Tsarist pogroms and Nazi Holocaust. And this was the place where these Northeastern Jewish people found a community, a place to live and practice their religious mores and enjoy life to the fullest.
And so they were, it was an elderly, mostly elderly Jewish population.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it was probably the average age must have been 80, 83, 84.
Why did they come here? Why did they choose this place?
It was the Catskills in the tropics, you know. And going back historically, of course, you had the Rat Pack and New Yorkers coming here to the Fountain Blue and the Eden Rock and the Carillon and the Deauville. But the congregation, the people started to move into South Beach, and it just became an elderly enclave from ocean to the bay.
And they were Holocaust survivors, and there
many
were people
were.
Who lost some, yeah, and also people who had lost family.
And those who survived, yeah. And there were people with tattoos in their forearms. It was not uncommon. Hmm. And there must have been, I think it was like 17 or 27 synagogues at that time scattered throughout South Beach.
And some of them were like in the hotels.
Well, that's another story, yeah. A lot, you know, during the pre-war years and post-war years, the hotels along Ocean Drive and Collins Avenue were still flourishing, but when the 60s rolled along and the old people started to live there and vacation there, the hoteliers would often convert their card rooms and social halls into makeship shuls. And
shuls are synagogues.
Synagogues. and many of the young people there were Orthodox, and every Tuesday and Friday mornings they'd pull out the Torah. It was, you know, it's quite enchanting. It was quite rare, too.
Wow. Well, you... you know, you mentioned the last resort. You referred to it as the last resort, and that is the name of the documentary film that came out, right? That came out recently, in the last couple of years. You and your photography are featured in that film, and you were shooting at least the early part of this project. You were shooting alongside your friend Andy Sweet, who shot in such vivid color.
Yeah, yeah.
And you shot in black and white.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm really interested in where that decision came from to shoot this incredibly colorful place in black and white.
It's probably personalities more than anything else, as well as an aesthetic judgment. Andy lived as sensationally as his photographs look. And I prefer to be a little more behind the scenes and make photographs that are a bit more formalistically different. I don't want to say more refined than his, but a different attitude toward the picture making process. And Andy was unrestrained, and I was restrained.
Well, there's, I mean, but like light and shadow seem to play such important roles in your photography. The photography from this time, I mean, the light really comes through. It South Beach is
you
a
can't
place
help
with
it,
so
huh?
much light, natural light. But one thing that I was curious about is. Well, if you could describe, that's okay. We all have phones that go off from time to time. That's okay. Maybe you could turn the ringer off. We do have, I was wondering though about the photograph, a lot of the photographs, but the photograph of the people who are like just floating in the ocean and the ocean takes up so much of the photograph. The sky is significant. If you can, this is the radio, so you know, if you could describe what that looks like.
Pre-1980, before the Mario Bolt left, a group of elderly people, probably as many as 40 or 50 on certain days of the week, would walk down to 10th Street and Ocean Drive when it was still dark out, and they'd enter the ocean before the sun would rise or as the sun was rising. And I would get up early and go down there at 6:30 also just to photograph that. But it was absolutely stunning to have these people just floating in the water, you know. I guess the bottom line is these people, young people, have nothing on these elderly people who lived life with such zest and fulfillment. And that was South Beach was all about. So yeah, the photographs were really just, I called them sunrise swimmers. And it was a wonderful activity, but when crime soared in the early 80s, it vanished like many things that were traditional up to that point.
One thing that strikes me about this photograph, I'm looking at it now, were you in the water, by the way,
when you took it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you took it from inside the water. It looks that way.
Yeah.
But the spacing, the space between the people in the photographs is really interesting. Like, they're kind of together, but they're not really. Yeah, there are no groups. They're all sort of in their own space within the water.
Space is what it's all about, I think, in every photograph, but that's shop talk.
Well, I'm here to hear the shop talk. Another one that struck me is the photo that looks like some kind of band, a group of musicians. Oh. Can you tell us about
that one? Loomis Park is the grassy area that goes from 4th Street to 14th Street. And I think now it's not used as much as it used to be. Then it was a place where people congregated every afternoon. And up and down Loomis Park, there would probably be four or five clusters of people bringing out their mandolins and their guitars, and they would sing and cavort there.
Is there an accordion in that book?
There's an accordion in that. And it was just a jovial environment. And it was a little surreal, too. I've had friends that are world-class photographers, usually photojournalists, and I can think of two top of my head that after photographing in South Beach back then, they said that was the most bizarre place they've seen in the whole world. But it was also the most endearing, and I think charming and culturally significant place. And
why bizarre? What felt bizarre about it?
Oh, gosh, it was a land of old people. There was no young people there. It was just everybody was in their late 70s or 80s. And I was the youngest person living in South Beach up until...
How old were you when you first started the project?
24.
This is a question I've always wondered about, and I've admired your photographs for a really long time. At 24, how did you know that this scene was something to photograph?
You know, back then, politicians would only come to South Beach when they needed votes. And in fact, they would come and hand out vanilla ice cream cups, Dixie cups of vanilla ice cream, and sing in Yiddish with the elder. It was just an ignored place. And even growing up here, like everyone else that grew up here, we didn't see quite how beautiful it was. We used to make fun of palm trees, for example. But when I was away at college, it just hit me that it was a precious legacy with an incredible lineage. And it was a vanishing world, and I just wanted to come home and photograph it for no reason other than to do it.
And you were in Colorado for college,
well,
right?
Is that right? Graduate school. USF is an undergraduate.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So for undergraduate, you were in Tampa.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was in Tampa when you realized South Beach was this place that really was meaningful?
Yeah, that's when Andy and I became friends and hung out, and I suggested to him that I'm going to come back after grad school and feel welcome to join me, and so we started it.
And wow. And did you say to each other, we're going to do this every day? Or did you just say, we're going to do it, like, we're just going to do it in a
Andy
serious way?
I told Andy that I would do it every day, and he would do it whenever I'd call him to wake him up at 11 o'clock.
Because you were a morning person and he wasn't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, the light, I mean, again, so coming back to the light and the light, I wonder if, so the photo that I'm looking at now is of a group of what we know from you telling us is elderly Jewish people doing what looks like calisthenics or
That's
aerobics
calisthenics.
Of some sort. Their arms are all up in the air in unison, and the light is just incredible.
That was Rose Silverman's group. She had a class that met every morning on the beach, and she used to stand on her head when she started these classes.
Wow.
And it was a sunrise, and the sun's behind them, and you're talking technically. You
so
know.
This is morning shot.
Yeah. You're not supposed to shoot into the sun, but it works so beautifully. You know. Yeah, they're just in those shadows. Just really, to me, it just captures the spirit of that time and that place.
Well, you're listening to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman, and I'm talking with the photographer Gary Monroe. He took photographs of South Beach just about every day, more or less, right, between 1977 and 1986. And some of those photos are up right now at the Frost Museum at FIU. That's up until December, and the museum is free and open to the public. Gary, How much time did you spend talking to the people you photographed in those days?
You know, I did a few oral histories early on. I didn't do a lot of talking. I'm kind of on the hitting and running, and I'm, you know, I would kibitz and talk. I spoke with some Yiddish, and I'm Jewish, so everybody got along very well, and they all thought they were my grandmother. But I wasn't really interviewing or trying to discern any kind of thesis from conversations. There was one person that we kind of adopted into our family in South Beach, but other than that, there was very little discourse.
When they did talk to you, is there anything you remember? I mean, I know you said it wasn't sort of a regular occurrence.
Yeah, no.
But
well,
was
I
there
talked
anything
to people every day. But a strong sense of Zionism and patriotism, complaining, a lot of kvetching, but in the good spirit of the word. And,
did they talk about the Holocaust?
No. So very seldom.
Yeah. Very, I mean, seldom. I think that generation didn't really much
didn't,
at all,
no,
even
yeah.
even to their own children.
It's on my oral histories, but that was not a point of conversation.
I mean, did you get a sense that they came here for joy? I mean, there's a combination in these photos of a real sense of joy, and I think there's also, like, you get a sense of loneliness at some point, too, in the photos. The photo of the man on the bed, can you tell us about that photo?
Somehow I went into many hotels and apartment buildings west of Washington Avenue, and I got invited to these places, and I did probably 150 or 300 portraits of people in their hotel rooms or small apartments. And there is a sense of isolation that comes along with being old in our society. So it's not all fun and games. There was a lot of suffering and some poverty, but it was never dire. The spirit was generally jovial, but you're right.
Did you know, well, actually, we referenced the man on the bed, but I don't think we really talked about that photograph. And I realize, again, this is radio, but I'd love to hear a little bit. I mean, he's got it looks like multiple newspapers or maybe multiple sections of a newspaper.
And I have no idea why. That's the thing. I don't do a thing. The less I do, the better it is for everybody involved. So I don't touch a thing. I don't direct people. I just look.
Oh, in terms of when you shoot,
yeah,
you just
yeah,
shoot them like
yeah.
where they are.
Everything. Yeah. I photograph what is there. And
so he's on a bed, and his pants are kind of pulled up a little bit high.
His waist.
and it's a twin bed, by the way. I should say it's a small bed.
Most of the hotels in Pullmanette had twin beds, and I don't remember ever seeing a queen or a double bed.
And there's so much light coming in.
It's flooded with light, morning light through the jalousy windows. Yeah.
When I look at this photo and some of your other photos, I think one of the things that strikes me, like, personally, from a personal perspective, in addition to the fact that, like, this is my neighborhood now, and this is, like, these are sort of the roots of some of the roots of my neighborhood, but it also looks like somebody who very easily could have been related to me.
Sure,
like,
yeah,
that could
yeah,
have been
yeah.
my great-grandfather,
yeah,
you know,
I know,
who never did live in that neighborhood, but my great-grandmother did. You know, I've wondered always, is my great-grandmother somewhere in, like, your stacks of photographs?
We've gotten, Andy's family and I have gotten a lot of calls after the movie came out, people saying this is, I think the one photograph of Andy's on the poster, Andy's brother-in-law Stan said he must have gotten 25 calls claiming that's their mother, you know, or grandmother.
Because there's such this like sense of familiarity
yeah, exactly.
in like this look
yeah,
and
yeah,
what people
yeah.
looked like in that during yeah. that era. So yeah. like, oh, that had to have been my grandmother. I did have my eyes peeled during The Last Resort when I was watching the film, like, where is Grandma Sadie? So when you were growing up in this neighborhood in South Beach, as a kid, before you became a photographer, like, what do you remember seeing before you saw it through the lens of a camera?
Wow. Going to school, walking through Flamingo Park to Ida Fisher Junior High School. It was just our home. You know, it was so different. It was quiet. You can park anywhere you want to park. And it was, you know, we had friends that lived everywhere. Although South Beach even then was not a place for young people. Most of the families lived above, say, 21st Street in Central Beach and North Beach. But it was, you know, in retrospect, it was paradise. I rode my bike everywhere, jogged everywhere, and it was wonderful.
When you did start photographing, when you came back and you really made this commitment to mm-hmm. the neighborhood as a photographer, did you know it was fleeting? Did you know
oh,
you
yes.
were catching the end of something?
Yeah, I mean, I knew they weren't going to be replaced by my generation of Americanized Jews that, you know, were not the same. And I knew that was the end of a very long lineage, and I thought it was really quite wonderful, and I felt very privileged to have found myself there.
So what do you see when you look at these photographs now? Do they look different to you that now than they did then?
Everything looks different. I see two things. I see satisfaction in my work, and then I see lost opportunities in my work. And I don't think people that work in the arts are ever content. I think discontentment is pretty much the source of creativity. So, you know, it's all dual. There's no one thing. And I just keep working.
You have so many. I mean, I don't know. Do you have like a ballpark of how many of these photos you took over that period of time, years?
Yeah, there's probably printed probably 2,000 big prints, but not all of them are very interesting. Maybe 10% are interesting. I don't think any photographer makes more than 5 photographs a year that make a difference, but that's another story.
It's a life
of failure.
Well, I think a lot of artists probably feel that way, but for you, what makes the top 5, or like what makes a photograph that makes a difference for you? Like when you're looking at one of your photographs, what do you see that says, oh yeah, this one makes a difference?
Again, it has to be formalistically resolved. It has to look like it's impossible to have made, but it could look no other way. I mean, the best photographs, mine, I think anybody else's, are gifts. I mean, I can't even look at a photographer's work if he or she signs the front of their print. I mean, it's not that. I can't even take credit for the best ones. I can just take credit for the 99% that are pretty pitiful. You know?
I think like Leonard Cohen, the wonderful musician and songwriter, said something like, it finds you.
Yeah.
I don't know. It kind of sounds like that's what you're describing.
Kind of an artless art. Yeah, it's weird. It's such a mechanical process, but it's not. And I can't talk about spiritual things, but it's a transcendent activity. I think looking at art is a transcendent activity, and so few pieces are transcendent.
So how did you choose which photos? And I know that
they chose me.
I know they chose you the photos. Well, I guess, and the curator too. You have the help of a curator in this situation.
I'd have to give credit to them. And of course, the Frost Art Museum. They know what they're doing, and Amy and Amy Galpin and Mariana Ramirez and Jordana spent a lot of time thinking and talking with me about this, and it came out beautifully. Small show, but it's really tight, and that's what I like.
Was there one or I know the photos that are in the show are the ones that you really felt strongly about, but was there like one that instantly came to mind that was like, okay, this one is absolutely in?
With a few, but it's really out of my hands.
Yeah.
And I'm not controlling that way. They can take whatever they want to take, and if there's a mistake, I'll try to nudge it the other direction.
Is there some degree of freedom in that? Having it not be in your hands?
I give up. I'm more interested in new work than I am in old work, but I'm glad they find excitement in dealing with how these can be reinterpreted. And the show is also part of their academic mission. They being a university-affiliated art museum, they curate to the needs of the faculty and students. So this show complements a show by a Holocaust survivor who wrote a book, and all the students have to read this book that are freshmen. And so it all comes together, and it all works out.
So then they actually get to have some connection.
Yeah.
It's like a visual connection with the written material.
And hopefully it inspires dialogue. And
so what are you shooting now?
You know, my interests now are far afield. I prefer to travel as far from home. And I was in the Baltic Sea region last year, and before that just in Europe. And I think next year I'm going to go to Eastern Europe and just keep doing it. I photograph around Florida. I come home to Miami to photograph, but it's so overwhelming. I mean, I love it, but I don't recognize it any longer.
Yeah, I was wondering if you still take photos.
I do, constantly.
Yeah. I want to see those.
Can't help it.
Well, I've been talking with the photographer, Gary Monroe. Gary, people can come hear you talk more about your work tomorrow afternoon at 3 at the Frost Museum. 3 o'clock, is that right?
3 o'clock, yeah.
At the Frost Museum at Florida International University. And the South Beach exhibition will be up until December. Also, you and your photographs are featured in the documentary film, The Last Resort, that we talked a little bit about. Gary Monroe, thank you so much for coming into the studios. I've been wanting to do this for a long time.
Thanks so much, Alicia. I appreciate it.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman. You're listening to Sundial on WLRN. Still to come, a new school of music opens in Wynwood. We'll be back in a minute, and I'll turn the mic back over to Luis Hernandez. Stay with us.